we're arguing today that the hedge force of today, it needs to address the ability of China to potentially succeed in a short notice invasion of Taiwan, and that our general purpose force is really not fit to purpose, you know, to really address that scenario at acceptable risk.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is the Air Power Podcast, powered by GE Aerospace. I'm J.J. Gertler.
And I'm Vago Maradian. For decades, American strategists have warned that systemic U.S. advantages in precision air power, stealth, space, and so on would gradually diminish as new powers develop new systems to counter them. Nations like China, Russia, and even lesser ones like Iran. The Hudson Institute's Brian Clark and Dan Patt have a new paper on what they call hedge forces, capabilities to deter or prevail in specific scenarios without having to build large single-purpose forces for those operations. Brian joins us today to describe the concept and how it applies particularly to air power, and we'll have this week's headlines in air power.
And it's all powered by GE. GE Aerospace is advancing revolutionary engine technologies for today, tomorrow, and the future. Learn more at geaerospace.com.
And the Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is also brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. JJ, what's in the news this week on All Wings Considered?
Vago, it's the season when the military services release their unfunded requirements lists, things they want that didn't make it into the president's budget request. For the first time, in my memory at least, the Air Force UFER doesn't include any more aircraft. Instead, it builds in readiness money to keep existing aircraft more capable more often. The Air National Guard has a separate unfunded requirements list. They do include 6 F-15EXs and 6 F-35s. Here's two great names that go great together. De Havilland Aircraft of Canada, having acquired the type certificate for Short Brothers Aircraft Line in 2019, is considering relaunching a modernized version of the Shorts Sherpa twin turboprop cargo carrier. That was last produced in 1990. De Havilland is currently engaging with potential users to confirm whether there's a role and a market for the aircraft, but you can see that boxy shape in the sky again in your mind, and maybe soon for real. Two other names you may not have heard together before, Denmark and Argentina. They've agreed to a transfer of surplus Danish F-16s to replace Buenos Aires A-4s, which were old during the Falklands crisis 42 years ago. Their replacement, a multi-decade saga that may finally be at an end. And Boeing has committed to building a factory in Australia to build the MQ-28 Ghost Bat. They're clearly feeling good about the international collaborative combat aircraft market. Vago?
You know, it bears repeating and reminding people that there are a lot of old Cold War American aircraft that are out there. A-4s are used by many nations and still to good effect, just like F-4 Phantoms are remarkably capable, especially in the Turkish and Greek air forces, where there are more modified versions of those aircraft that actually, you know, perform the mission really well because some of these airframes were just extraordinarily well engineered and designed and still fit for purpose. I think it's interesting the Air Force is putting that modernization money in, and it makes sense given that the Air Force does want to step up its capabilities. So it's going to be interesting how many airplanes the Air Force is forced to end up buying at some point. And the only other thing I'll say is, given that de Havilland is one of the greatest names in our business, any opportunity to make sure that de Havilland is still in the airplane business in any capacity is okay with me, even if it's in the form of something as glamorous as the Shorts Sherpa, which almost nobody would see as sleek.
No, not a triumph of aerodynamic design. It was designed on a day, apparently, when all they had in the shop was a ruler.
But it is a very, very capable airplane, right? I mean, if you wanted a good box that does a lot of things and has short takeoff and landing capabilities.
But also interesting that we've got one story where you've got an older aircraft finally being replaced, and another story where, you know what? The older aircraft is a pretty good idea. Let's build more.
And don't miss the other weekly podcasts on the Defense and Aerospace Report Network. Cavis Ships, hosted by Naval Savant's Chris Cavis and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by GE Aerospace. They clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink, with space guru Laura Winter, who takes a thoughtful look at all things galactic. And our Technology Report, digging deep into cyber, chips, AI, and more. It's hosted by Vago Maradian.
And joining us now is our good friend Brian Clark, the director of the Center for Defense Concepts and Technology at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, who, along with his colleague Dan Pat, are the authors of Hedging Bets, Rethinking Force Design for the Post-Dominance Era, which I believe is a terrific work that folks should be paying attention to. And fortunately, folks up in Congress and in the department are paying attention. Brian and his team have really been doing some incredible work on mosaic warfare, on systems warfare, and indeed on novel ways of countering some of the disadvantages that we have. Brian, great to have you back on the program, and sorry that Dan couldn't join us today for this conversation.
Thanks, Vago. Thanks, JJ. It's great to be here again. Great to be on the Air Power podcast. Not my normal haunt, so thank you very much for inviting me.
Indeed. It's always great to have a former submariner and a Navy man on the program. And I should point out to our audience that Brian was able to join Chris Cavas and Chris Cervillo on the Cavas Ships podcast in late February. And I suggest folks check that conversation out, where you were talking, Brian, a little bit more about the naval aspects of the report. Right. We're going to focus a little bit on the air power aspects. But what you have in common is developing innovative ways for sort of the general purpose force to have some special mission capabilities. And I thought what's impressive about this 64-page report, it starts with a very powerful line. The era of U.S. military dominance is now coming to a predictable end, which is something that the late, great Andy Marshall would have said, you know, four decades ago. He was warning, we have created these second offset advantages, and they're going to be perishable. And we looked at it as if the whole world really was never going to catch up to us, and we're kind of drunk with our own success in terms of our capabilities. And now that's evaporating. Walk us through, what are those historic American advantages that are most perishable, given the capabilities that not just the Chinese and the Russians are developing, but the Houthis, right? A proxy force, right, with help from Russians, Iranians, and Chinese, for example, are able to project as well.
Yeah, Vago, it's a great point. I'm glad you brought up Andy Marshall. My first work when I left the Navy in think tank land was working on a study for Andy Marshall, looking at the future of the mature maritime precision strike regime, as he described it. And Andy Krupnevich did some great work on that as well when I was working for him at CSBA. But yeah, that was Andy's point, was that, you know, we are eventually going to reach a point where everybody's got these weapons. And then what are the implications of that for how military competitions play out? And we're sort of reaching that point now. We can see how even the Houthis, you know, a relatively irregular force being supported by kind of a third-rate power in Iran, is able to field, you know, precision strike weapons with lethal capability against, you know, ships in the Red Sea. Arguably, that is a pretty confined body of water, makes the targeting problem easier for them. But just the same, they are putting a lot of pressure on U.S. naval forces, who are having to respond with relatively expensive surface-to-air missiles to defeat those threats. And only now the Navy is starting to field some, you know, maybe alternative capabilities to do that more effectively. And as you've said before, they've been able to use guns in some cases against these drones. But overall, though, it's been a very stressing problem for the U.S. Navy, and that's a third-rate power supporting an irregular proxy force out in the field. Look at, again, now at Russia, you can see that, you know, the Russian military is not what the Soviet military was, but if the U.S. force had to go up against today's Russian military, there'd be areas of stress, because Russia's been able to really exploit the advent of these precision strike weapons, both in the traditional missile sense, but also in the sense of drones and how you can overwhelm an adversary with those. And then cut to China. China is able to take advantage of both its technology proliferation that we're talking about here, but also its geographic advantages, right? So any fight that involves China against the United States is likely to be in China's backyard. So China is going to have this positional advantage of being able to bring all of its mainland capabilities to bear in any conflict that we're likely to have with them, as well as being able to focus their entire military on that region. So that, you know, the Chinese don't have the global kind of worldwide alliance responsibilities the U.S. does. So they can focus all their military posture on the region of interest to them, which we don't have that luxury of doing. So a lot of factors are driving that end of that era of dominance, and that we could have, and like you said, Andy Marshall predicted. And so now we have to think about, okay, well, in an era where we no longer have that dominant position, what are the ways that we need to regain advantages and be able to take advantage of emerging technology to try to get the upper hand on some of these opponents? And that's what we try to get at in this study.
A lot of folks are familiar with the concept of hedging in the financial world.
What does it mean in the strategic world? And to help understand, how have we seen it used in the past, if at all?
Yeah, great point. So when we've had these periods where the playing field has essentially been leveled between the U.S. and a potential adversary, we've had to figure out ways to address those most stressing scenarios other than just by using a general purpose force. You know, so we tend to want to have a general purpose military that's a one size fits all force that can address any scenario that you present to it. And in the period after World War II for a while, we might have had that. And then arguably after the Cold War ended, we had that. You know, the general purpose force could handle pretty much any scenario it was likely to face. You know, but then you get peers that come up and present challenges that are going to exceed what the general purpose force's capacity and capability can deliver. And so you can either, you know, skew your military and optimize it for that stressing scenario and hope that everything else is covered. So the lesser included cases, a model that we have used in the past in the period after the Cold War, for example. Or you can look at ways to create specialized forces that help you to hedge against those most stressing or high consequence scenarios. So back in the Cold War, one example of this is the Soviet military grew rapidly after the end of World War II. Their nuclear arsenal started to grow relatively quickly as well. And the U.S. was trying to recoup some kind of peace dividend. And so you saw with the Eisenhower administration, the New Look strategy said, essentially, we are going to use nuclear weapons to offset or to augment our conventional forces in any fight against the Soviet Union. So in Eisenhower envisioned nuclear weapons being at play right away in any conflict with the Soviets or the Warsaw Pact. That shifted as we moved into the mid-Cold War with the Kennedy administration, who, with flexible response, said, well, okay, nuclear weapons are not necessarily on the table for every conflict with the Soviet Union. We're going to use those as a way to offset our potential numerical disadvantage or our conventional disadvantage against the Soviets. So arguably in that 1960s period, the nuclear force became a hedge. So we're only going to use it if it was necessary to overcome a disadvantage that we had conventionally. And they even created in the budget a major force program devoted just to nuclear programs. So in the budget documents, we created this separate force for nuclear. And in the way that we thought about it, the nuclear force became hived off and was this totally separate part of the military. That's arguably a hedge force of the past. And we're arguing today that the hedge force of today, it needs to address the ability of China to potentially succeed in a short notice invasion of Taiwan, and that our general purpose force is really not fit to purpose, to really address that scenario at acceptable risk.
And you mentioned Taiwan, right? And we're going to get to the air power conversation for those of you who are waiting on this, but we think it's important to get the foundational elements of this down because it is very important, right? I mean, since the general force is not fit for purpose, you guys want to, have those augmenting capabilities, most of them unmanned air, unmanned sea, and other systems, as well as novel combinations of existing weapons. And we'll get to that in a second. You mentioned Taiwan as one of those extremely high consequence, but low probability threats, right? What should fall in that basket, right? I mean, a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, Chinese blockade of Taiwan, right? Which I think might be actually a more plausible thing the Chinese may want to do to just sort of strangle the island as opposed to invade it or cause a collapse of leadership. Walk us through what those scenarios are, because once you know the problem, the solution actually becomes a little bit easier.
Yeah, Vago, great point. So these high consequence, low probability scenarios are ones that you would not want to drive the design of your general purpose force, right? If you've got something that's very unlikely to happen, you don't want to make that the design function or the objective function of your military. And what we saw over the last 5 years or so is the DoD making those kinds of choices. So unfortunately, because the China-Taiwan scenario was such a high priority, even though it's low probability, we continued to shape the budget in ways that optimized the force for that invasion scenario. So we were cutting amphibious ships or not buying new ones and retiring them early. We were getting rid of littoral combat ships that were not as relevant to that scenario. We were cutting strike fighters, that were not as relevant to that scenario. And as a result, we started to see some impacts of that, strike fighter shortages, the inability of the amphibious fleet to support disaster relief or NEOs in the European and Middle East theaters. And, you know, a shortfall in terms of small combatants. And we see that today with what's happening in the Middle East. We're having to use destroyers to defend shipping in the Red Sea instead of frigates, which is what ideally we would have been doing. So these choices that have been made over the last 5 years have been shaping the U.S. military to be better suited for that China-Taiwan scenario, but then making it worse suited for everything else. And I think we're seeing with the budget that just got released, a move back, you know, kind of a withdrawal or an arresting of that trend and trying to restore some balance to the force. And then the other scenarios that might present similar challenges, for example, let's think about, you know, if Russia were to decide to, you know, attack the U.S. mainland, you know, with maybe submarines. So if Russia was to deploy its entire submarine fleet or as many as they could deploy at one time, that could pretty much overwhelm the U.S. anti-submarine warfare capacity in the Atlantic, especially if it was combined with some kind of operation in Europe that required additional U.S. forces to deploy there. So you might want a hedge force, you know, that hedges against that possibility too. Again, it's a low probability that China or that Russia would attack the U.S. mainland with submarines, but the consequences are enormous. So we need to hedge against that, but we don't want to optimize the overall military to solve that one problem.
And that is an excellent counterpoint to all those who say, well, the only thing we need to worry about is China and tailor the entire force exclusively to China, when that's only one scenario. With all due respect to the former commandant of the United States Marine Corps, is a very important assignment, but it can't be the only assignment, given that, you know, we use Marines in a whole variety of tasks, from embassy evacuation to quick reaction forces, just like we need a Navy to be able to do stuff in the Red Sea, to be able to do a whole bunch of things around the world. And we don't have enough of those forces. I think you guys noted, right, the ships were unavailable to do humanitarian missions, in part because the whole fleet was increasingly in the Indo-Pacific and focused on a whole bunch of other missions. And so you need a way to augment it. So your point is, still have general purpose forces, use these hedge forces for these specific instances, right? So still have a broad air force to be able to project broad air power, but then have special mission capabilities in the hedge force.
Right, absolutely. I mean, so we're seeing in the Middle East, for example, you know, shortfalls of strike fighters, shortfalls of air defense platforms, air defense ships, because we've been choosing only the highest end platforms that are relevant in the China-Taiwan fight, which we can't buy very many of. So now there's not enough capacity to go around when you have challenges like are presented by the Houthis in the Middle East or other proxies. And, you know, God forbid, if there was a Russian action against the U.S. or NATO, we would certainly lack the submarine surface combatant, you know, air capacity to be able to deal with that scenario, while also considering the other challenges around the world that the U.S. has to address. So these hedge forces are designed to start, you know, hedging against those high consequence, low probability scenarios and allow the rest of the general purpose force or the general purpose force overall to be remain more multi-mission, remain more flexible, and be able to address the broader range of situations the U.S. might have to tackle.
So what do they need to look like, these hedge forces? What are the attributes that distinguish a hedge force from your general purpose force? How do you get them to work together with general purpose forces? And hey, this is an air power podcast. So specifically for air, what are you looking at as a hedge force versus general purpose?
Yeah, great point, JJ. So the hedge forces would need to be, you know, because they are going to be additive, we would want them to be, you know, inexpensive. And therefore, you know, they're probably going to be unmanned to a degree because that allows you to get to a cheaper system. But if you really want to have an inexpensive unmanned system, it's probably going to be slow or it's going to be short range, which means you probably need to position these forward, because if they're slow, it takes them a while to get into position. And if they're short range, obviously they need to be proximate to the area where they may be used. So those general considerations drive you to, well, primarily an unmanned force, probably forward positioned and probably designed to stop an enemy from doing something, because fundamentally the U.S. is a status quo power. So we're looking for unmanned systems that can help deny an enemy the ability to operate in a particular area or to reach some objective. And that cost and range and payload calculation, you know, is something we put into designing these forces. And then we think about, you know, the air element of it. Let's talk about the China-Taiwan scenario specifically. So what we talk about in the study is using unmanned systems in each domain. So undersea, surface, and air in a combined force that would operate, that's all unmanned, and that would be able to operate in essentially a three-dimensional kill box, where you're approximate or next to the coast of Taiwan. And if anything comes to that kill box, these systems go after it. They act essentially as a mobile minefield in the air, on the surface, and underwater, with pretty modest automatic target recognition capabilities. And they're going to basically go after any target that comes into that area. So friendly forces would stay out of it, just like we do today with anti-submarine warfare free areas or minefields. And then, you know, the enemy forces are going to have to, you know, beware if they come into that region. So that's the overall design of the force. And when it comes to the air component, you know, one really interesting thing that came out of the modeling that we did for this study that we described, you know, in depth in the report, is air capabilities, you know, like the Altius 600, Altius 700 UAVs, like the six-inch diameter form factor UAVs that are often used as loitering munitions, are very effective against ships, not because they're going to sink the ship, but because they force the ship to activate their air defenses. By activating their air defenses, they make it much easier to do combat ID. So as opposed to just having a mass of ships in an amphibious task group, you can now tell, well, which ones actually have a air defense radar, and that might be a high priority target for us, and which ones might be amphibious ships that we might also want to try to target. That ends up being extremely important to the overall success of the defense of Taiwan operation and of the Hedge Force, because one of the biggest challenges U.S. forces face right now is being able to differentiate the right targets to attack inside of these amphibious fleets that are coming across the Strait of Taiwan, because there'll be a lot of decoys, there'll be a lot of extra ships, there's escorts, there's amphibious transports, there's roll-on, roll-off ships, but they're all going to have different electromagnetic signatures. They're all going to operate differently. And so in a lot of ways, the Hedge Force is designed to make them reveal themselves and help with that combat ID problem so that long-range fires can be more effective when they reach that target area.
You're talking about interconnecting, though, submarines, for example, with bombers. I know that we've done a lot of work in this sort of connectivity, and we don't have to get into the specifics of it. But in executing this head strategy, you're also using some, you know, general purpose force elements in it, right? So talk to us about where the existing fighter force applies, where things like B-21 apply. You say it's particularly important because it is a much stealthier airplane than F-35. And how do you employ all of these systems? And you guys note this, right? Large formations of anything, whether they're F-35s and stealthy or surface craft, are going to be visible in sort of an open source intelligence network where, you know, you might not have as many signatures, but you might have photographic evidence of, you know, a formation coming at you, right? A satellite image. What are the elements of the conventional Air Force that are needed in order to execute this? And how do you execute it in a ubiquitous surveillance environment? This mobile kill box minefield approach you have would be detected by the Chinese, and they would then have presumably a counter to it.
Yeah, great point. These are great questions. So to start with, the idea is that these hedge forces, these unmanned systems, would spend most of their time not in the kill box, right? So they would operate or be positioned in the Sakishima Islands of Japan, for example, the Southwest Islands of Japan that are right next to Taiwan, or in the Batanes Islands of the Philippines, which are next to Taiwan. The U.S. Marines have been operating in both places, and that might be the force you might want to have operating or managing these hedge force systems. And that if it appears that an invasion may be brewing, you know, within, you know, 24 hours or so, you can reposition the hedge force and put it into its kill box. And these systems will all be able to make that transit within the 24-hour timeline that we're talking about here. And the beauty of it is if the invasion turns out to be a feint, you know, the Chinese come out, do an exercise, and then go home, well, it's relatively low cost. We just bring the hedge force back to where it came from, as opposed to when we have to sortie a strike group or, you know, sortie a lot of bombers to go and try to do some show of force, which is expensive and burns up the force. And using the hedge force for those kinds of responses is much less expensive and much less stressing on the overall force. But then these units, you know, once they're in position, they would mostly be operating, you know, with themselves. You know, so they're going to coordinate amongst themselves in terms of doing some attacks. The collaboration would be pretty, I would say, primitive. It's not going to be, you know, highly sophisticated collaboration, because more or less it's a mobile minefield. They're just going to attack the things that come into their field of view and into their kill box. And what would happen is the targeting mechanisms that are used for our long-range fires, that our B-21s, our F-35s, our submarines, our destroyers are going to use, they're going to all be harvesting that data independently. So the hedge force doesn't need to talk to the manned forces. The hedge force just needs to generate the response on the part of the invasion force. So that now we've caused all these signatures that could be revealed and then detected by either overhead, you know, space-based satellite sensors, or even just overhead airborne sensors. And that gets passed back to the attacking forces, and they can use that to target their long-range fires. So the key here is the hedge force and the general purpose force operate, you know, complementary to each other, but they're not actually integrated with each other. That way we avoid the challenge of dealing with a very contested electromagnetic environment that might prevent us from being able to talk from one force to the other.
Brian, when I hear you talk about large numbers of very inexpensive systems, I feel like I've heard those phrases before. Wait a minute. DoD is working on something called Replicator, a way to create large numbers of inexpensive systems. Is that an essential for the hedging force, or is this something that can be developed independent of that initiative? How do they inform each other?
Well, I definitely think they inform each other. You know, so we started working on this before Replicator came along, but I think Replicator could certainly be the mechanism that you would introduce a lot of these systems into Indo-Pacific Command's theater, and then into a unit that would manage the hedge forces, right? Because some command structure will be needed to manage this hedge force. You'll need people to maintain the systems, people to do the programming, people to oversee the movement of them back and forth if they're going to, you know, move between Taiwan and the Japanese or Philippine Islands. So there'll be some people involved there. They'll be in some kind of command structure. They'll work for Indo-Pacific Command. But the delivery of those vehicles to them could be done via the Replicator Initiative. And I think it's essential that you're going to have to get that kind of scale to get the prices down to where you do get an affordable force. In the study, we presumed some very conservative numbers with regard to how much these systems cost. And it came in, you know, we estimated at about $6 billion for the overall hedge force to be purchased, which, you know, in the grand scheme of things is not a huge amount, but if you spread that over a few years, then that's about what your Replicator Initiative is attempting to spend. And we really focused on, you know, the systems that exist today. So like I said, the Altius, you know, airborne vehicles or loitering munitions, some unmanned surface vehicles like those that are built by Saronic or Magura, which is a Ukrainian company that have been very effective in Black Sea operations. And then undersea, there's a wide variety of UUVs that are out there, from HII with Hydroid or Speartooth, which is a new vehicle from the Australian company C2 Robotics. There's lots of vehicles out there you can draw upon that exist and that could be, you know, easily weaponized for this purpose. But I definitely think Replicator is a path that we could use to deliver this. And then I think the key would be coming up with a command structure for this to operate with Indo-Pacific Command, so somebody actually owns it and somebody's going to employ it.
So you've noted, right, I mean, there was a lot of concern about autonomy and autonomous weapons and, right, I mean, Terminator scenarios, whereas you're making the case that for reasons of practicality, and this is how our adversaries are going to be using these systems, they're going to have autonomous systems that are going to be far less discriminating than ours. But you're also making an observation that there would be an NTM, right? A note to mariners,
right?
You know, note to airmen, avoid this airspace because it's going to be contested, right? So,
right.
Because anything that is in that space might well be targeted, right? That's the easiest way not to hit your own friendly forces, but it's going to prompt some people to ask some real questions, right? I mean, does a Filipino ferry get hit with a box of torpedoes under the water that just hears something that's, you know, not a certain plan signature? Right. I think we can figure those out, right? I think we can be a little bit more discriminating on sound pressure levels so that the fishing boat with the bent propeller isn't taken out. Then again, you know, if you're Chinese, you might want to use a fishing boat with a bent propeller in order to mask yourself, right? So how smart do these systems become, and how do we avoid potentially catastrophic outcomes like ferries being sunk or cargo ships being hit? And then how do we do the combined joint all-domain command and control of this? I mean, folks in DoD tell me, and on the joint staff, we're making a lot more progress, right? It's JADC2, CJADC2 has become a bit of a lightning rod, but we're on the cusp of a real advance. Where do you think we are, right? Because you're talking about, again, connecting submarines to bombers, connecting bombers better to other elements of the force, while at the same time trying to do the identification and the targeting, which would mean also that air systems are targeting with less degree of surety because they're operating forward in a denied satellite connectivity, right? So you're going to have to do enough computing on the edge to have this autonomy. within a reasonable bound, right? What does this look like for those people who might be worried about, you know, air systems that are hunting and killing with impunity? You don't want to make them with impunity, but there also have to be certain understandings of what their actual capacities are going to be like. And you may not have 100% IFF confirmation before you shoot at something.
Yeah, yeah. So the so in terms of autonomy, we tried to make it so that the autonomy required for these individual unmanned systems was very minimal. And that's why we use this idea of the three-dimensional, you know, mobile minefield. So there's a kill box, and then they use geographic separation to say, if you're within this box, you're free to, once you've been activated, once we turn the force on, you're free to attack, you know, any targets that you see. And then we can put in some very kind of modest parameters on the ATR, because the ATRs that exist today for electro-optical and infrared are pretty good, but I don't think you want them to try to make a determination as to whether a large ship is a fishing trawler or a combatant ship, right? It certainly, they can do it, but it's certainly beyond what you might want to expect in a wartime environment. So we use geographic separation to enable the autonomy that's reliable and available in these systems to be employed for the purpose of this mission. You know, and when they're transitioning over to that region where they're going to be in the kill box, they'll be deactivated, right? They're just going to be in transport. Someone's going to, they'll be carried, or they'll just move themselves into the kill box, and then they'll be activated. So to your point, when they're moving between the Philippines and Japan and Taiwan's coast, they'll be in a deactivated mode, and then they'll be activated once they're in the kill box. And then, you know, for the CJADC2 element of this, I think that that's a great point. And one thing that DoD has been working hard on is this joint fires network, which is how do we provide the targeting information to a launcher like a submarine or a B-21 or an F-35, so they have enough information to launch, because you have to meet certain criteria in order to actually release the weapon. But then that weapon is going to have to be retargeted or to get target updates in flight, because you're launching from max range. It'll take an hour or 2 hours for them to reach the targeting area. These ships are all moving around. It's going to be a rather chaotic environment. So the launch is almost independent of the targeting. So they launch the weapon makes its way over to the Strait of Taiwan. It gets some kind of update from an airborne or space-based sensor or communication capability. And then that gives it its target update to go final targeting on the contact that it's supposed to engage. So the targeting process in this scenario ends up being increasingly that the launcher launching the weapon has a vague idea of what it's actually going to hit. But then once the weapons get into the AOR, then they'll begin getting target updates. And then that's where the real target allocation will happen. So it's very interesting, just because of the contested nature of the environment, because of the ranges at which these aircraft are launching weapons, the targeting takes place in two different phases that in a lot of ways might be really disconnected from one another. So the CJADC2 part of it is, how do we create that ability to both give targeting information for launch and then target updates to enable final engagement? And the hedge force's role is to complement that by slowing down the invasion, disrupting the invasion, you know, maybe sinking a couple of ships, and then also primarily to give this more cooperative targets for the missiles to come in and engage.
And finally, as part of the rollout of this study, you had a public conversation with Dave Alexander, the CEO of General Atomics Aeronautical Systems. He's been a guest of ours a couple of times. And when he was most recently on, he was talking about how the collaborative combat aircraft might have to look rather different than we'd been thinking about. I know Vago, for one, has been saying that for a long time and advocating for different solutions.
Right.
What were your takeaways from that conversation about how to think about this whole complex problem?
Yeah, I thought Dave had some really interesting things to say, particularly about, you know, the unmanned space of, I guess he was calling them like medium vehicles. So not very small ones, like maybe the 6-inch, you know, loitering munition like an Altius, and not, you know, the big unmanned vehicles like an MQ-9 or an MQ-4, but, you know, these little medium-sized ones like CCA. And his point was, if you want that CCA to have the same range, relatively same signature as the manned platform that it's accompanying, it's going to end up being, he didn't want to bring up a number, but the number is more like $30 or $40 million. So nearly the price of a fighter. And then you're not going to get the capacity or the numbers or the scale, you know, that you're looking for. That's much more of a loyal wingman idea than really a collaborative combat aircraft that's going to be out there in numbers. And so what he's arguing is we need to get to a smaller form factor, more modular construction, you know, kind of what they're doing with the Gambit, you know, series of UASs. And the first version of that's the OBSS, the offboard sensing station vehicle. But that is going to get you more into that, you know, single digits, you know, maybe $3 to $5 million range of having an aircraft you can actually buy at scale. And maybe it's not multi-mission capable. Maybe it doesn't have the same range as the manned aircraft. So it has to get launched from another platform or another place on the way to the target area. But that's the direction he sees CCA as needing to go, because that price point is what's needed to achieve the scale. It also maybe is more versatile, right? With the scale, you can create a more heterogeneous mix of unmanned vehicles. If you put these into your hedge force, for example, it would create more difficulty for the Chinese in figuring out, well, which payload is this vehicle carrying? How are they working together to collaborate to attack my targets? It's not as obvious, you know, than if you're just facing a bunch of F-35s and you know that everyone you kill is going to take out a pretty significant chunk of a U.S. capability. One last thing I'll add is one thing that the study highlighted, and we did our modeling for the study, was the value of B-21s, bombers, basically, with the hedge force. We ran a model run where we just had submarines, which provide some firepower, but not a huge amount, and then B-21s, and then the hedge force. And in that model run, actually, we had just as much success in terms of stopping the invasion. Basically, no invasion attempts resulted in a lodgment ashore. And the losses to U.S. forces were much less, because the B-21s were able to stay at standoff, launch their weapons. There were fewer of them compared to a bunch of F-35s, so it's, you know, harder for the enemy to detect them. And that ended up providing the best results of all. And the one outcome of that was it would help address a particular concern that I think is growing within DoD, is these scenarios where we have potential large U.S. losses, which all these war games for the China-Taiwan scenario show are likely, that could cause U.S. leaders to be reticent to intervene, right? If you're looking at, you know, in our model runs, you had almost every unit that got thrown into that fight without the hedge force suffering a mission kill. So if you're looking at least a mission kill for almost every unit you send into that fight, are you going to be reticent to intervene, or are you going to seek some accommodation instead? That's a big concern that is growing within DoD. And so a question is, how do you do this response to an invasion without risking the kinds of losses that might cause somebody to hesitate in the White House? And this model of using bombers and the hedge force ended up being the model that does that.
Before you go, I've got to slip one compound question in there. The U.S. Air Force is changing what the Air Force is going to look like, right? Air power leaders decades ago sort of envisioned this. If you read Dave Deptula 30 years ago, he was saying that actually the next generation aircraft might need to look different, right? And over the years, that NGAD might be a very different airplane, a big airplane, a lot of payload, a lot of range, coordinate that forward battle, and that you're using actually the unmanned systems to be projecting deeper and forward into denied airspace, for example. And now that looks like exactly what the U.S. Air Force is going to do. Even if the NGAD is the highest end capability, the CCAs are going to be controlled by a wider group of the force, right? So you still need your B-21s, you still need your NGADs, but then you need large fleets of these other aircraft that could conduct missions in, you know, less hostile skies very easily, but also become then integral to this future hedging force, as you said. Folks thinking the right way about the problem? And what do you expect to hear next week at the Navy League's Sea Airspace conference, given FAXX has been delayed, right? And you spend as much time looking at air, sea, land, space, and everything else, you know, cyber. What are you hearing from Air Force leaders that you find encouraging or not? What do you expect to hear from Navy leaders? Because it doesn't appear the Navy has nearly as cogent an approach to this, perhaps, as the Air Force does at this point. And I am not trying to stir up, you know, a Zoomy Navy conversation here, but I'm just asking the question.
No, I think you're onto something, because I've often thought that myself. I think the Air Force is, you know, definitely moving the right direction. You've had a lot of discussions with Frank Kendall, we've even talked here about it. But clearly, this model of moving towards having a relatively small number of larger, higher end manned aircraft, you know, with a growing number of unmanned systems that are a tenth or less than a tenth the price of those manned aircraft, that definitely is the model that I think our hedge force is highlighting is being the model of the future to deal with some of the inherent disadvantages we face geographically, but also, you know, just the challenging technology proliferation that's happening. And so I think also in these smaller systems, you can get the ability to do technology refresh cycles, adaptation much more easily than you can do in your highly integrated manned aircraft. So I think the shift towards, you know, smaller number of manned things, a larger number of unmanned things has a lot of benefits, not just in terms of the force size and structure and the idea of using a hedge force, but also it gives you this ability to refresh technology much faster and maybe get an advantage over an opponent that maybe can't move as quickly. And then if you look at the Navy is kind of, you know, the air wing of the future is really in flux, right? There's no idea really from the Navy in terms of how they're trying to evolve the air wing, which, considering the investment we've made in carriers, is, you know, verging on malpractice. At some point, we're going to have to make investments in the air wing that make that investment in the carrier worthwhile. And with FAXX moving out, I think the Navy's going to have to think about, you know, unmanned solutions to try to fill out the carrier deck, especially when you look at the kinds of ranges they have to operate over and the inherent constraints of operating from a carrier. So I could see the Navy having to, you know, expand its reliance on MQ-25s, even though, you know, that program is, you know, having some hiccups right now in terms of delivery and timelines. Or even look at a second, you know, unmanned vehicle that might go on the carrier deck to complement the MQ-25 and to complement, you know, a shrinking number of Super Hornets, because they're eventually going to age out. And I think with FAXX being pushed out, that might just be the direction the Navy goes, and that eventually they replace the Super Hornets with a small number of these FAXX aircraft. You know, it's not going to nearly be the one for one that I think they originally envisioned.
Anytime we have Brian Clark from the Hudson Institute on the program, I feel my brain stretching bigger. Brian, thanks so much for joining us on the Air Power Podcast.
Thanks, JJ. It was great to be here with you.
Absolute pleasure. And stretched brains are what we're all about here on the Air Power Podcast and the Defense and Aerospace Report. So we appreciate the mental calisthenic, Brian.
Thanks so much for joining us on the Air Power Podcast. And if you liked what you heard, hey, tell a friend, unless you think it would give them a competitive advantage. Thanks also to GE Aerospace for powering the entire flight. We'll be back next week.